The official derivation of the word symbol is not the one that we use, but I will tell it to you to see whether you agree with it as a derivation. From two Greek words, one meaning together and the other to throw, sim, together, the ball, balein, to throw together, separate significances. The word symbol was used in the early Christian church, and much earlier, to signify all those shapes, whether mineral, vegetable, animal, human, or other, all those shapes which, meditated upon, would give some key to a special kind of activity. Now, we use the term sim as equivalent to seed equals potential, and ball for vol for volition. So we use symbol as signifying a seed of will, that is, a particular device which, when meditated upon, allows you to determine a direction of the will, which without the aid of that symbol would not be possible. Some of the more devout of you may have been watching the 9-hour program of the papal visit, and you may have noticed that they have various garbs and different kinds of hats, and these hats are put on and taken off and another one put on, and certain deliveries for certain purposes have different hats and different cloaks, different garb. The word garb itself is related to garble, to talk in a certain manner, and we will begin by pointing out that there are four recognized methods of interpretation of any scripture. We are to remind ourselves that the religions that are apparently different, like Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, etc., all those apparently different religions are not different religions. They are the same religion, disguised in different terminologies. The great worry about the papal visit has been whether there would be rioting by Protestant elements that disagree with Rome. So far the thing has gone fairly peacefully. But in the past there has been much bloodshed. There have been killings about beliefs within the Christian fraternity, as there have been in every other major religion. Every time there is a difference of idea, as the idea has an effective charge, and the effective charge results in different types of activity, then the idea embraced is very important. To change an idea, which is basic, to an emotion, which is basic to an action, is to change the world. The world is changed by mankind, and mankind is changed by ideas. So we're going to go briefly through the four methods. Would you like me to write them down, or would you just commit them to memory? And somebody must have written them down. That must be not an aquarium. I shall write them down. I'll have to see what margin I've got to play with. I'll put a dot. Is it a dot? Yes, there is. Alright, let me one. Literal. The literal meaning, can that be read? Can even the back row see it? The literal meaning of a thing is the most naive meaning there is. That is to say, if you say, the other day I saw a cow, you mean a certain type of ruminant that wanders about in the fields eating grass and converting it to milk. If you say, I saw a cat, you mean a certain kind of quadruped that goes about uttering meowing noises and lashing its tail when furious. And if you say dog, you have another image of a quadruped animal barking, growling, and so on. The literal meaning corresponds with the external physical factuality. And the literal meaning itself is always safe. That is, if you're telling the truth and there is a tiger, and it really is one of those very large quadruped pussycats covered with stripes and very hungry, if it's really there when you say there is a tiger in the room, then it's generally considered necessary to be careful. The literal meaning of the tiger is that it is a large, dangerous quadruped. When hungry, it might eat you. Now that kind of thing, when we tell the literal truth, then we can adjust to the gross material facts. But there has been for thousands of years another way of talking. You all know Mao's remark about threats from the West. They come out of the mouth of a paper tiger. He doesn't mean a large quadruped with stripes from the jungles of India or the mountains of Siberia. He means a person that would like to be as powerful and ferocious and terrifying as one of those large quadrupeds, but is not at all like that, and therefore he's called a paper tiger. The essential thing about a paper tiger, it has, for all practical purposes, two dimensions, not three. You draw the paper tiger on the paper. It has height and it has width, but it's got no depth, at least no greater depth than the ink. And a two-dimensional tiger with height and width cannot jump on you and eat you. But a human being could say, I am a tiger, and roll his eyeballs and make funny tiger noises and frighten a baby. Now the moment we need the concrete, the literal meaning of a term, and start using that same term in another way, then we can say we've entered the second meaning, and that is allegory. Now, allegory means to read other than you have written. To read other than. They say there is a tiger in the room, and we really mean it's a man with very fierce, appetizable nature. If we don't mean that big pussycat with the stripes from the jungle, but we mean a man who is ferocious and likes to think that he's like a tiger, we've moved down to the literal level to the allegorical level. Allegory means the Allah part, that means other than, and the leg is reading. To read other than. So if I saw a mouth of a man, that would mean a man that's timid, or at least he's supposed to be timid. So I have picked up a little mouse, a field mouse, and she's very courageously bitten me on the thumb and fought back in spite of its small size. When we talk allegory, we say things other than would be the normal literal meaning. So if we say the kingdom of heaven is like a grain of mustard seed, and a mustard seed is a very small seed, and it grows into a big tree, and all the fowls of the air come and rest in that tree when it's grown. But that is a parable, that is an allegory. We read other than we say. The kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed does not mean that it's like a seed of that mustard plant. It means that it has a terrible compulsion inside it. It's must, it's compulsive towards growth, towards expansion, towards power. The kingdom of heaven means the balance of power attained from a primordial seed suggestion that power is worth having and is attainable. Not power over other people, power over oneself and one's reactions. The kingdom of heaven is like a vineyard tended by men, and they are keeping the grapes for themselves. And the owner of the vineyard sends his manager to see them, so they stone him to death. So the owner of the vineyard sends his son to the vineyard to collect the grapes, so him they kill. Now, you're not to say that literally, in the naive sense. You are to say that the moment you start trying to secure a balance of power inside your own being, there will be reaction inside you. Your body, including your brain and your mind, is like a vineyard. And if you tend it carefully, it gives you fruit, grapes. The grapes, you say, ferment, make a drink, which makes you drunk, which makes you talk foolishly. In the same way, the ideas, which are the fruits of experience, can also make you drunk. They can give you ideas of great talents, marvelous performances, and overthrow you, like the grape can overthrow you. And when we talk in this manner, we're talking in the manner of the allegory, the second mode. When we come to the third mode, how do you spell harmony? Does anybody know? Is there a Y on it? A Y? Oh. I thought it looked a bit short. Part of the Pope's performance was an address called the Homily. And the essence of the Homily is this. It is something said to a mass of people. It's not said to a select few, it's said to a great crowd. It's something you say to mobilize a great crowd of people to take an affective or emotional attitude towards the ideas being presented. It is intended to move a mass of people. You don't give a homily in private to your best friend. You give a homily to a large, very large audience. And it is designed primarily to move them emotively towards a certain kind of action. You all know that kind of talking. You've seen the great evangelists, the Billy Grahams of this world, with large audiences, perhaps 80,000 people. And you may say to them, it is a pity that there is trouble in the South Atlantic. And after all, we are all brother Christians, all brothers in Christ, committed to peaceful living together, and yet we are fighting. So I recommend you all to pray very hard for the cessation of hostilities, the attainment of a peaceful settlement, and the re-establishment of trade between the Argentine and Britain. And you say this, but you do not say how to get it. Everybody has to be at peace with everybody. A statement was made recently from the Vatican that men are rational beings, and instead of pursuing a violent solution in the Falklands, because human beings are rational, there's no reason why we shouldn't have a rational dialogue and just keep the dialogue going. And by dialoguing together, using rational debatings, arguments, all rationally framed, because human beings are rational beings, then eventually, perhaps in 1,000 years, or 5 minutes, according to the strength of the argument, there might be a double withdrawal, a shaking of hands, and a decision to design a new flag, partially Union Jack, and partially Argentine. This is because we are defined there as rational beings. Now, this is a very great argument within the Church, Is man a rational being? He has been defined so by many philosophers since the early Greeks. Is man a rational being in the sense that he can think according to the rules of logic, and having so thought, agree to abide by the rational conclusions to which he comes? Is man really like that? Or is man like something else? Is man a volitional being? A being of will, who sometimes will reason and sometimes wills not to reason? Which is power, the will or the intellect? This is a great debate between the Dominicans and the Franciscans. One says man is rational, intellectual, and the other says no, he is not. He is first willful, and only if you can persuade his will to be reasonable will he be reasonable. Now, if you define 100,000 people in a large stadium as rational beings, and you do that with very great persuasive oratory, you might actually get heads nodding like this, saying, yay, yay, verily, we are rational beings. And therefore, we agree that there should be an interminable dialogue instead of fighting. And then they'll all go home and beat the wife up and kick the kitty and throw the dog out. Because there is a tendency to forget. When you suffer from a homily and go home to the realities, the clash of personalities, rationality tends to subside and you start becoming overheated. Maybe it's the rising temperatures that do it, that raise the temperature of the brain. It is well known that when you raise temperatures, electrons start to jump, and when they jump haphazardly in the brain, they make all kinds of weird connections and you make irrational statements. You could say, I loved you before we were married, but now I don't. You might say that when you're very, very hot and 2 hours later you're hungry, no meal has been cooked, your rationality starts working again, so you apologize. Now this definition of man as a rational being, as we shall see in a moment, is only partially true. We are able to reason to a point, providing the reason does not conflict with our basic will. When we are addressing a very large crowd, we give them a homily. We try to persuade them that they are a certain kind of being, like an all-forgiving, all-dismissing of past crimes, all-forgetting of sins against each other. I will come and kiss you all, the kiss of peace on your right cheek and your left cheek. And then, because I'm tired, I may stoop a bit. And at that very moment, my rival may stand up straight to take advantage of my stoop. And there can be tremendous upstaging at the very, very moment when this kind of interaction of rationality is occurring. But if we can persuade people that they are of a certain kind, like rational, and will follow a rational argument, that is, they know the rules of logic and adhere to them, if we can persuade them that, for the time being, they may actually believe that they're rational and behave very kindly towards each other in that large stadium. And when they're going out and the exit is narrow and they start pushing, and some remember that they're a little late for another appointment and they try to get ahead and they get overheated in the pushing, the rationality may vanish. The effect of the homily vanishes. And talking to very, very large crowds of people does not perfect those people, because the perfection of a human being depends not on a homily, but on very hard individual self-examination and dedication to that very purpose of self-knowledge, self-control. There are three modes of thinking, and there is a fourth one. This one doesn't like to be written, and we'll see why in a moment. If we get it to write, we'll be very lucky. It'll be very pale. See if you can read it. We could mechanically say it's drying out, he thought. Can you read that? Does anybody know if this is poisonous? Maybe if a kid is, in which case you might write better like that. So I'll spit on it every time it dries up. We have biblical examples of that because Jesus spat on the clay on the earth, mixed it up and put it on a man's eyes, and then he was able to see better. It's a very good trick if you know which kind of mud to use. The ladies that go to beauty parlors know all about that. Anyhow, if it dries up, I shall spit on it in the manner of the great ones of the past. As a matter of fact, one of the Ethiopian priests' best greetings is to spit in the eye of the believer. It is derived from this miraculous cure. And the fourth method is the mystic. And the mystic means absolutely unique significance for the individual. Not the literal tiger, not the allegorical paper tiger, not the homiletic tiger where you're persuading a nation that they have been wrongly aggressed against and it is now time for them to be like the tiger. Not that, but when you personally, individually, by your own effort, come to terms with your own inner tiger. And nobody knows exactly the nature of that self-discovered tiger except the individual discoverer of it. And that is called the mystic. I won't bother you with the full Hebrew terms, but I will put down their initials. And then if there are any Hebrews in the audience, they might tell you. I'll tell you the top one. It's S-O-D. I'll tell you that one because it's short and easy to remember. It means the mystical. It means the son of the mystical doctrine. Son of the doctrine. The S-O-D. And that spells a word. Originally a Persian word. Like that. Can anybody guess what that word is by inserting a few vowels? Well, we'll put an A in there for pronunciation, and one there. We'll put an I there, we'll put an E on there for fun. Paradise. Now, paradise means beyond duality. Beyond the differences of these four modes, there is that mysterious quintessential intelligence that is able to comprehend all those four meanings within the pure consciousness of the individual. And observe, only an individual can do it. No one can do it for another individual. You can discuss, but you cannot make another person get the message. You cannot make the penny drop in another person. Sometimes you kick the slot machine, the penny does not drop, and the owner of the machine arrests you. It's no good beating people to enlighten them. It doesn't necessarily work. So there we have four meanings, and we telescope them together in this word paradis. Beyond duality, paradise means the state that we can enter into when we understand those four levels of meaning simultaneously and decide which one is most appropriate to use in a given situation. We nearly got to come, didn't we? So there is a mnemonic for you, P-R-D-S. Think of paradise. And when you think of paradise, think of beyond, para, duality, the this part. And remember these four levels of meaning and in discussion with other people or with yourself in isolated meditation, determine exactly which level of meaning you are using to yourself, so that you don't fall into allegory when you're supposed to be being literal, and you don't start a silly homily to yourself, like telling yourself what a marvelous creature you are and lecturing all the cells of your body as if they're a vast mob, which they are. And recall the mystical one, it is unique. You cannot give your meaning away to anyone. You can approximate to it. But supposing we say the word dog, and supposing the person we're talking to is just an Alsatian, and your dog is a Chihuahua, and you praise the characteristics of your dog and don't mention that it's Chihuahua, and the other fellow thinks you're talking about his Alsatian qualities and doesn't recognize them, it is impossible, not just improbable, it is impossible for you to convey exactly what you mean to another person. It is very difficult to convey what you mean even to yourself. In the privacy of your chamber, try it sometime. On even the simplest word, try to define it adequately, and you will find that you're not quite satisfied with the definition. And the moment you start extending the definition, it proliferates outwardly to infinity. Because the more you define it, the more insights you have. And you can't carry on with your work of defining without increasing your number of insights. So you're always behind comprehending it. And the moment you look at it to comprehend it more closely, you discover a new thing that you didn't see before. So it actually retreats to infinity at the very moment you're trying to comprehend it. We'll wind that on. We'll now go on to the method of dealing with a symbol by analysis and synthesis. I'm going to start with a Roman Catholic favorite symbol called the Sacred Heart. There is actually one in this hall at the moment, just been put into visible expression on, I think it's a t-shirt. Is it a t-shirt? Very quickly for this occasion, there is a lady wearing one. And she has done it herself, perhaps aided by enthusiastic husband. I'm going to analyze this symbol. This is a heart. Is that all right? Maybe I should look myself occasionally. That is a heart. Now the heart, as you know, is a symbol of feelings, of emotion, of compassion, of liking the thing, of toleration. If you like to go through the Roger's dictionary of synonyms, you'll find lots and lots and lots of words for heart. And they all have to do with the feeling life. A life of feeling, the aesthetic life. And the thing about feelings is this, they are immediate. Feelings are immediate. They come. And when they're there, and when they're not there. And they come spontaneously. So that feeling life, represented by the heart, is a life of aesthetic immediacy. The immediacy of an emotive response. And then we have another symbol. And this represents, I won't bother to do the finest details, that represents a wreath or crown of thorns. It's a circle made of thorns twisted together. And it symbolizes the intellect as a product of the feeling life. And it symbolizes conscience. Con science means with knowledge. The thorns are the prickles of conscience. Every time you feel spontaneously like doing what you want to do, and you haven't thought of the results, and you do it, if something happens that's horrible, if you offend somebody, or you yourself find out that you made a mistake, then you are pricked with conscience. And it's elective self-accusation. And then here, that represents flames. Does that look like flames? Doesn't that look for flames? We're very near the edge. Flames. Now, the flames could be the flames of zeal, the amount of energy you put into a thing, or if you have spontaneously done something and that thing has gone wrong and produced a comeback which you don't like, your conscience then starts pricking you and accusing you of being so many times of a fool, and you blush for shame and you actually feel yourself go hot. No doubt you've all at some time in your life, though very, very rarely, made a mistake and blushed. Do you remember? Or is it too long ago? So the flame signifies the fire of purgatory. The P-U-R in purgatory is fire. The P-Y-R in Pyrex is from Greek for fire. First you feel like doing something spontaneously, and then you do it without thinking of consequences. Then the consequences hit you, and your intellect then says you were a fool to do that, and continuously pricks you, continuously accuses you of being a careless fool who has actually put you on the spot. And then you blush with shame, and ordinarily you turn away from the unpleasant feeling and you try to suppress it. Now, if you try to suppress it, you may succeed and it will lapse from consciousness and you will not go into that situation again because you have suppressed it, and you will be unconsciously on guard against a repetition of it, but you will not be reflexively enlightened about it. So the correct thing to do is, when you make that kind of mistake that makes you blush, enter into it in private, in your own room, and go over exactly the purpose of that feeling which you had, and go through all the intellectual accusations against yourself, and face them. And you feel hot, and you deliberately penetrate into the flames. That's called entering into the fires of purgatory. You will then be purged because you will actually see clearly, not repressed into the unconscious. You will see clearly exactly what feeling misled you into that act, and you will be able to counter the intellectual proddings, the pricklings of conscience, with a truly logical reply, and you will be able to design for yourself a new process. And when you have gone through the fires of purgatory, you will then have a cross. I meant a cross. Is that like a cross? Just about. The cross means committal. It means having done something spontaneously with your feeling, having got into trouble through it, having been pricked with the conscience, having faced the fact that you made that error, not buried it, you face it thoroughly, and then you burn with shame, but you face the fact that you're burning with shame, and you don't suppress it, you enter into that fire, and you examine with the greatest care and precision the error that you committed, And you then design for yourself in the middle of that fire exactly a better way of doing an act in those situations and circumstances. And when you have designed that way, then you have made your cross. And you commit yourself to it. Take up your cross daily, says logic, and follow logic, and then you will have the completed sign. There is the heart, which is the feeling life, and here is the cap, the thorny band around it, and here are the flames of shame. And here is the cross of committal. Well, probably you've seen that. And if you're a Roman Catholic, you may like it. And if you're not a Roman Catholic, you may feel that you don't like it. But don't have a rational or irrational dislike for it. Have a determination to get the full value out of that symbol. And she's telling you in one gestalt, in one diagram, what we have analyzed. See if another one will dry up now. What we have acquired out of this is an immediate symbol which is actually a key to the whole of life. And such a symbol set up on a postcard in front of us can actually make it possible for us through meditation to avoid the grossest kind of errors that is committed daily by most people. We have taken a symbol, we take it to bits, introduce the bits, and then put them back together again. Now the important thing to recognize is this. Before the analysis, the whole situation was present as a pre-analytic whole. But we don't know what is in the pre-analytic whole until we analyze it. So there is an idea in our minds of feeling, of making a mistake, of the prick of conscience, of the burning shame of the error, and of the determination to commit ourselves to a better mode. And we've got this as a whole feeling, a gestalt, a whole pre-analytic fact of human experience. And then we break it down into its parts. And when we have so broken them down, it clarifies for us the meaning of it, and then we put it back together again and draw the symbol to fixate in our consciousness the meaning of this thing in all its complexity. And when we do this, we finish with a diagram, and it is called sacred heart, because sacred means secret. And as we said before, the individual has to do this work. It's no good a homily for millions of people. The individual must actually examine his own feeling, his own prickling of conscience, his own shameful burnings, his entry into purgatory, and his final committal. And it is always unique. Pray in secret is the rule, and your Father, that is your generative power, will reward you openly. It is no good praying in the millions in a colossal stadium if you're not strictly examining your own basic feeling orientation, your prickling conscience, your shame, and your committal. And if you do examine them in that way, you cannot convey to another person all the steps whereby you finally arrived at that committal. No one can do it for another person. That is one breakdown. And then we had another breakdown of another symbol. And see how this one goes on. This symbol is a piece of cord twisted three times. It's an aspirate letter in the ancient Egyptian. An aspirate letter means a letter of power. When you say ha, you are talking about power. When you scoff at a threat and say ha, you are actually talking about this power. It's a single piece of cord twisted three times. Now the meaning of it is that life itself is continuous like that cord, but by twisting it you make it apparently have three parts. One part is the head, only visible now. One part is the chest, one part is the tummy. You get a couple of loose ends there. The cord is to remind you that you are one. You are a unific being, but by self-twisting you have become functionally three. You think, you feel, you will, and you do these things separately until you learn to do them simultaneously. You think one thing, feel another, and do a third until you learn to integrate it. So there is a letter, that's the thrice twisted cord of Hermes Tekuti. And then there is a rod. The rod means unity of direction, accuracy of measurement, accuracy of evaluation. The twisted cord is twisting. It is misrepresenting its unity. The reality of the unity is one, but the one by twisting looks like three with a couple of loose tails. The rod, pole or perch, is a measuring device, something on which you can lean, something on which you can erect a tent. Rod means to rule by division. Rod means you measure in order to control. And this rod is a reverse of door. Door, like the door you walk through, and the door in adoration, have the same base. D-R-R-D means discrimination, division into categories, and accurate measurement of all the parts. That one, do I hope, for a pair of wings. Does it look like a pair of wings? Or a lady's blouse? They're flying up, I better bring them down a bit. Supposed to be a pair of wings. Now the wings, in all the major religions, mean the speed of thought. The speed of thought. Thought is very quick. You can be in the Antarctic Ocean falling out of a helicopter into very cold water now by thinking about it. You can think how very unpleasant. And you can do it very speedily and decide you'll change your mind. You will not go to the Falklands this summer for your holidays until this matter is settled. You do that with the speed of thought. Now, it then develops further. We have to find why these were put together. They were put together, I'll put them over here for a moment. That would do for the wings. That would do for the rod. And this will do for the thrice twisted cord. Can you see that? Is that visible? It's called the caduceus. Caduceus. Caduceus to carry, to lead. The car, dog. Dog, Fido. Fido, believer. How to lead believers. That is how those three parts are put together. Now we're going to show a development of this thing, because the thrice twisted cord can be divided by the rod and turned into two serpents. I'll put them in little heads on for you. I'll make one serpent a fat one and one serpent a thin one. We'll discuss why we're doing that. One of those serpents is a powerful fat one, and the other is a thin one. The significance is this: the serpent means sensuality, sensuous appetite. And you have two modes of using it. One is where you think you're powerful, you dictate terms to a weaker one. That's this fat one. The other is that when you think you're weak and think you cannot dictate terms to a stronger opponent, you go to Uno and debate it instead. You wheedle. Where you believe you haven't got the force to compel subordination of the other being, then you tend to wheedle. And every human being, every animal, every vegetable has these two forces in it, and the mineral world too. We won't bother about the mineral world at the moment, for that's to do with electrical polarity. But the vegetable, the animal, and the human are perfectly obvious. Because some trees, like the oak, are very strong and stiff, and some, like the willow, give way. So there are two modes of possible response. Where you're terribly strong, you tend to be bossy, and when you're not terribly strong, you tend to be wheedly. And everybody, without exception, all living beings, without exception, show both of these behavior patterns. Bossy where they feel they're powerful, wheedling where they feel they're weak. So the thrice-twisted unific cord has now become two separate serpents, and they tend to operate separately. That is to say, one moment you're full of power and pushing around and getting your own way, and the next you're blocked by the bureaucracy or the establishment or even a fellow with bigger muscles. And at that point you become polite. You go to discussion. You wheedle. And no one is free from these two serpents. Now the problem is raised, what to do with the serpents? The serpents were there first, because they were the single life cord, and they were divided simply by the difference of powers, because all individuals are unique, and because of those differences, they were relatively strong in one case and weak in another case, and so produced two separate behaviors in every being. One, a behavior of power, telling somebody off because you think they're weaker than you are, and the other is you start being polite and wheedly because you believe the other fellow is more powerful than you are. And they have actually become separate in the human being, in their functions. They're functionally separate, although they are manifestations of the one unific life force. Now, how do we create the rod out of the two serpents? We create the rod out of the two serpents first by confession to oneself. You don't need to confess to anybody else. Confess to yourself that sometimes you wheedle and sometimes you push hard, and that these two functions have become separated, and now it would be more beneficial for you, more efficient, if instead of letting them operate unconsciously separately, you put them together. Now, if you then look at your wheedlingness and look at your power and remember they're derived from a primordial unity, you start pulling them in together. You narrow them. You pull in your wheedling when you're trying to persuade somebody. You pull in your power demonstration when you're throwing your weight about. And by this mutual pulling in together, you gradually form the rod of office out of these two serpentine tendencies. That rod cannot be formed in an individual in any other way. Any way other than straight looking at this duality of behavior, wheedling is in the presence of the powerful and bouncing about in the presence of the weak. When these are admitted, and then you deliberately curb the wheedling and the power both, you pull those powers in, and gradually they come together, and they make for themselves a rod. And with that rod, you can measure everything in the universe. You can measure the boast of heraldry, the pomp of power, etc. With that rod, you can see it operative in other people, the bouncing and the wheedling. You can measure it with your rod, but you can't measure it accurately with the serpents separately. They've got to be together. And it's got to be that you confess to yourself that you have this wheedling and this bombastic, boasting serpent internally. And you have to squeeze them in together. And then they make the rod. Now, out of the top of the rod, when you have that, then comes this marvelous development of the wings. They grow out of this rod. They won't grow any other way. As you compress your wheedling serpentry and your bombastic serpent together and form this rod, the energy goes up the rod and blossoms forth into wings. But one of these wings is a hawk wing and the other is a dove wing. Don't mistake those two wings for belonging to the same bird. One of them, the hawk one, belongs to the fat serpent, and the other one, the dove one, belongs to the wheedling serpent. But you've now got them both under control. So you could actually forcefully wheedle if you so willed, or you could wheedle forcefully if you so willed. Because you know that you've got the hawk and the dove as faculties, properties of your own being. And there's much talk about hawks and doves in the world these days, in the political world, in the world of military conflicts and coups over governments and overthrows of states. Much talk about the hawks, and at it again. The hawks are very horrible predators, and the doves are very, very nice, neat people. It's always been badly done to. That is not true. Every dove has got a hidden hawk, and every hawk has got a hidden dove in it. We've got everything within us. So that when we see that simple sign of the Caduceus of Hermes, and we remember that it means all these pairs of opposites put together, and out of this self-control process, a control gained not from outside by imposition of power, but from inside by the growth in meditation of insights about our true nature. Then we are entitled to carry the Caduceus of Hermes with us and to use it as a mnemonic and an anchor for consciousness. Now, all the great religions use these symbols, and they disguise them in various ways because they don't want other people to know their own technique. I'm going to put down one or two little examples from different sources, and they all mean exactly the same thing. The same thing as that Caduceus, but disguised. So we'll have this one. You have that one in? Hammer and sickle, is it? Well, the sickle is the female wheedler, and the hammer is the male pusher. And it has exactly the same meaning as that caduceus. And here's another one. This is a Turkish one. You see, the sickle is again the feminine soft wheeler, and the five-pointed star is the male five-sense empirical calculator. Exactly the same meaning. And then there's another Russian one before the revolution, in which we have an I and an O and two serpents, like that. You know that one? Have you seen that one? Have you seen it in a Russian language program on the television? The opening of their program? Well, the two serpents are separated there, that were wound together in the caduceus, and the O means the feminine, and the rod means the masculine. It has exactly the same meaning. And here's another version, this time an Indian one, which might be that way up, or it might be that way up. And one means a situation, threefold, think, feel, will, and the other means the pusher into situations. And then we have an Egyptian one, which is the Shruk Sansata, like that, called the handle cross or key of life. And the loop at the top is feminine, and the T hanging down is masculine, and the meaning of the diagram there and in the I Ching is peace. When a person has the intelligence to note that the feminine is vulnerable, number vulva means a wound, and turn down the aggressive instinct, do not enter into aggression against the vulnerable, and then you have peace. Because if you do the contrary, there is the vulnerable, and you aggress against it like that, then it may or may not respond profitably to your aggression. That is like the Lady Chatterley's lover, that's the Lady Chatterley's lover, and that is Lady Chatterley. And then this is the seigneur with the right of first night on the bride. You see that one? Now the same symbol, presented in different ways, says, key to life, wherever vulnerability is, protect it. Do not aggress against it. Help it out of its vulnerability. But at the bottom, the plowboy might climb up to the ground, the lady, if she accepts the offer. And the maid, the chambermaid, may become a princess, like a film star did once, on encountering a highly placed male. Now all the symbols have a multitude of meanings, of which four of them are literal, allegorical, homiletic, and mystical. You have to meditate on these symbols in those four ways to get the full value. And you needn't worry about exhausting the meaning of the symbols in your first half hour's meditation. It will not happen. And every time you come back to it newly, you'll find you think of something that you didn't think of before. Now we're going to examine a letter, one letter of the Hebrew alphabet, to show the same symbol disguised again. This is the letter. We'll draw this one first. If we had a big broad reed pen, we'd fill it in. I've drawn the outline. First we draw this one, and you notice it's curved. It symbolizes the curve from the infinite that comes in, and winds round, and goes out again. And then on this side, we do a little drawing of an axe, or hammer, or an axe hammer, Some early flint axes are also hammers. One edge was sharp and thin for chopping, and the other was thick and blunt for banging. This is called a weapon. And down here we have a drawing of a bent blade. Now that is a Hebrew letter Aleph. The first letter of the alphabet contains within it the whole secret of all the other symbols. And it's still saying the same thing. The man with the chopper has force. The man who hasn't got the chopper bends the knee. And the bending knee is the wheedler. When you go into a marvelous palace belonging to an already established emperor, you are required to bend the knee. And if you haven't got a large enough chopper to deny the necessity of bending the knee, you'd better bend the knee. Otherwise, if you're the milkman looking for orders, you won't get them. You go to the back door of Buckingham Palace and try to get an order for Bovril. It's very, very probable that they've already got that one for free for a long time. Your axe there, and the word axe means spirit. It means absolute self-contradiction, conflict. Why should there be conflict in the absolute? Because the absolute is infinite power, and there isn't anything else but that power. If it doesn't create, there is no problem. But if it does create, there is a problem, because the only way it can create is by locking up portions of itself. And then the locked up portions kick against being locked up. So in every act of creation, there is war, acts. If you want to have a rest, you have to tie up your axe for the time being. In the Bible it's called beating your swords into plowshares. But don't sell your plowshares and leave yourself without potential swords. Let's look at this letter again, rather more fully. This time I'm going to draw a circle. I'm going to put this letter inside the circle like this. I'm going to call the circle and everything enclosed within it the island of security, the island of culture, the island of civilization. The island, as the anthropologists call it, the island of the tonal, the island of defensive unity, the island of unified power, secure against infinite possibilities on the outside. Now, we're going to put letters inside this one. It's a little letter like that, yod. That's a jot or dot. I'm going to put that inside the axe. The name of the axe in the Hebrew is Zayin, a weapon. It's the seventh letter of the alphabet, a weapon. And I'm putting a yod inside there, a dot. And then, opposite to it, the bent leg, I'm going to put a vav. That's the sixth letter. I'll draw you one of those. It looks like tough to do a yod. And you make it long. It's just the same as a yod, but its tail is longer. And in the original Egyptian, it was simply like this. Just in case you can't recognize it. It means push, drive, conation, the power to get there. The yod means precision of idea. The yod means knowing what you're doing precisely, having good formal information about the subject matter. And the verb here means the capacity for applying that idea by pushing it with tremendous energy. And then in the middle here, I'm going to put the letter H. I'll draw that, I'll put it here. I hope you can see it. Can we see that? Just about, yes. Now the letter H means life, means breathing, means the process of input, output, the exchange. You let something go out and you get something back. And if you try to retain your breath and don't breathe out, you will die. So it implies a reciprocal relation between you and the external world. And these letters are placed, Yod, He, Vav, inside the circle. But when we come to observe that there's another He outside there, outside the circle. And that one means life, but it means life absolutely transcendent, life beyond the created individual, an infinite ocean of life, not caught into individuality, not encapsulated. I'll just wind it back a bit to there. We're going to write these letters again. In that manner, can we see that? Now that is the Hebrew name of God. That's the one that in English you call Jehovah. Jews don't actually pronounce it, they substitute another word for it, because it's a very powerful mystical name. And it says an idea with a field of interest and a drive with a field of power around it. So we will now examine the same thing, Yod, that's the head, He, that's the shoulders, Vav, that's the heart, and He, that's the legs. That is a drawing of a man, vertically. But when we write it horizontally, it is the name of God. Written vertically in that way, it shows you its origin. But it contains within itself all that a human being has got. He has a head full of ideas. He has arms and shoulders for executive power. Those powers of execution are necessary for the idea to be expressed in the external world. He also has a feeling, bringing out of the heart a feeling that goes down towards manifestation in the world and mobilizes the legs to go about. Now, as long as your feeling is in your heart, you are said to be unfallen. We will now draw a man called Fallen. Here is a man of ideas. Those are his arms, and these are his legs, but his feeling power has now dropped into the genital organ. Now that's out of a drive in the universe towards reproduction. And it says, reproduce, otherwise you will not leave a mark in the world. It is a fall out of the true center of the heart, which you remember is a center of compassion, helpfulness, universal love. But if that power falls down into the genital center, it energizes the reproductive tendency and immediately loses all compassion, all sensitivity to the other person's needs, wants, and becomes a tyrant over the person who is supposed to own this department. That is the drawing of a fallen human being. Now you observe, on this side, the letter is unbroken, but there's a little gap here, broken. You are to take it that this is a symbol of the totality of human possibilities in the universe. You think, you feel, you drive, and you express in the world. And these are your possibilities. And if your thinking is clear, then the application will be precise. And if your feeling is compassionate, you will be sensitive to the situation's possibilities, and you will go about. And we said these three were in the island, and that one was out. Now if we write for island, I-L-E, and X for out of, exile. That's for hay in exile, outside the island. An infinite life, an ocean of intelligent, sentient power, extending infinitely in all directions, is the ultimate reality. But that life cannot express itself unless it gathers itself in, encapsulates itself in islands. And each of these islands of encapsulation is an individual. And the human being who understands the economy inside him knows that he thinks, he feels, and he wills finitely within his body, but there is an infinite life outside his body which responds to everything he does. So it is not possible to do something without an effect being produced by that which is done. The effect is because the infinite life, which is exile outside this island, responds to the decisions and actions initiated inside the island and modifies the pressures outside and so changes the situation. Every time you think, you change the situation in your mind, in your feelings, and in your cognitive possibilities, in your will. You change you, and because you change you, you change the world. And the world then changes itself to accommodate itself to what you think and feel and will. No man, no matter how clever, can get away with it releasing causes and producing no effects, because the infinite life will produce effects whether you like it or not. And ignorance of the law is no excuse. Where you try to manipulate life in an individual or in a group or in the universe, life itself has got the whip hand from before creation, before the island was made, because the infinite life is the source power of those little islands of individuation. Now all the symbols that we meet in all the religions telling us the same thing. We'll take the same thing and we will now cut it. We will say the thinker and the executive, and we will call that one a male insofar as he is dominated by the logic of ideas. And another one, we will do this, and we're now dealing with the fallen and we will say that one is the female. That's very interesting, because in the Hebrew, if we wish to spell she, we write this one. And if we wish to spell who, he, that one. That spells he, which means she, and this spells who, which means he. And this he is male because it means orientated towards the idea. That half of humanity that is orientated towards idea, towards reason, towards formal logic, towards mathematics, towards geometry, towards all formal controls, is the one that we call the male. But the one that is orientated towards the sexual relation is female. So that when we say who means he, we mean the field of the phallus. And when we say he means she, we mean that the female tendency is looking for an idea to take it out of its chaos, to give it clarity, to give it bad direction from the idea. And when we say who, which means he, we're talking about the being that is trying to demonstrate by push, by drive, that it is a male. So in the female we have an orientation towards a male who has an idea that he can push, but in the fallen female we have an orientation towards genitality, towards the phallic drive in the man, which the female then thinks if she can get hold of that drive and train it, she can point it in any direction she wishes to go. Whereas the male is thinking, if only he could get an inspiration, a field that invites him to perform, that would be a good relation. The relation of the woman is to find the drive power and the intelligence and then persuade it to work in a certain way for the relation with the woman. And the man is looking for relation to be recipient of his drive. And that's in the fallen. Now in the unfallen, the same drive power is situated in the heart, not in the pelvis. It could descend to the pelvis, but it is not centered there. It can relate, it can marry, it can have children, and so on, but it is not centered there. The pelvis is not the center of the authority of the unfallen. The unfallen is centered in the heart of compassion, the heart that feels the conditions, that knows the state of the other being, and that makes allowances for vulnerability. So that heart is a complete being where all of these are put together. That means you don't need any further diagram. It rolls up. You put together your idea with your feeling of compassion and sensitivity to the needs of the situation, and you drive intelligently towards the goal, but with supreme sensitivity to what is and is not possible. And if you do this, you are neither male nor female. You are both or neither. This is where the great sages of all the major religions have taken this idea of the male-female, female-male, the hermaphrodite. They put together Hermes of the thrice-twisted cord and Aphrodite of the sensuous life in the same being and make a balanced, bipolar human being who is neither overstressed male nor overstressed female, but comprehends both aspects of the being in him herself. All the symbols that we see are seeds of the will. That is to say, when you meditate upon them, you will find your will begins to change when you meditate on the symbol. And you see the symbol as a key to modification of behavior. And you find automatically that where you see a course is better than another course. If you're at all balanced, you will use the better course. But if you get overheated, and if you become angry, furious, the energy will jump, leap out of its proper pattern, because the electrons in your nervous system will jump out of their tracks and they will go on to other tracks and they will make accidental relationships. All that you call accidents are the product of energies jumping out of their appropriate tracks into other tracks simply through overheating. So you have three K's: cool, calm, collected. And we have to remember that the number of nerve endings in the body does not diminish as you acquire self-knowledge and through self-knowledge, self-control. In other words, your capacity for happy enjoyment does not diminish when you understand yourself and the mechanism of the body and brain and so on that you have built. Because it is true that the body, as you can see in your bones, is a kind of machine. The bones are like levers and they're pulled with muscles. The whole body can be viewed as a machine, and all the brain processes likewise. But then man is not a machine. He has made a machine to ride in. His body is his chariot, and he has designed it himself, for his own unique self-realization. Every man, every woman has an idea which is their own special idea, a unique idea which they know more about than anyone else. And this idea has got an effective charge around it, a biomagnetic field which energizes the idea. And when that charge increases to a certain height, it overflows, and it's then called emotion. Emotion means it's going to flow outwards. And when it flows outwards, it becomes cognition. Now the idea, therefore, is a very mysterious thing. The idea is a very compacted power with tremendous significance in the very simplest idea. Think of the word dot. The least mark we can make is a dot. Think about dot and how do we spell it? We spell it D-O-T. And D-O-T means a zone in which we are crucified, draw a circle, put a cross in it, and you will observe that you have divided it, draw the circle, put the vertical in, you now got two D's back to back, draw another like that, and you've got two D's, one above, one below. So in the act of taking your circle, which is the O, that's a samach in the Hebrew, you have marked off a zone for activity, you have posited an intention, and in the act of positing that intention, you have made yourself passive to the idea. Now, every time you get an idea and wish to express this idea in any way whatever, when you get the idea and you consider it worthy of use in expression, you put yourself under the idea. You go under the law governing the idea. The idea is a form. The form is a compaction of infinite energy, and it's compacted by interest. Where you are interested, the field is interested. Where you're interested in an idea, the whole universal field of power condenses onto that idea, and that idea vibrates and gets stronger and stronger, and finally the idea dictates to you. You might think you've got a good idea, but when you meditate on it and see it's a very good idea, instead of you having got the idea gets you. Like Hitler's 1,000-year Reich got him. Like many great people have thought, dreams of empire. And then the idea has got them. Like Napoleon going to take over Russia and coming back with cold feet. The idea gets the man. So that you have to be very careful of the nature of the idea to which you give yourself. The idea that you feed with your interest, and remember it is interest that feeds an idea, draws in from the surrounding infinite field more power the more you have interest, until finally the idea takes over and conducts your light for you. And therefore, there is really only one idea that is safe to put in your mind and embrace. Can anybody tell me what that idea is?
Love.
Love? It might be. How would you define it? See, we take the word. Now, the usual meaning of the word love is want. It's something nice for oneself. We use it as working for the development of the potentialities of being. But that's very, very difficult to handle. Because how do you know what another person's potential is? You have to go into dialogue with them. And you have to question them over many years to find out what they really want to develop. Because being unique, only they know what they want to develop. They and no one else knows intimately what is to be developed. So although love is a very nice word, and love is God, and God is love, there is another idea.
The idea of breaking the idea.
The idea of breaking the idea. That's very close to it. It is the idea of dialectic. It is the idea of asserting simultaneously a pair of opposites. The only way you become free from the dictatorship of an idea is to oppose the idea with its opposite. And then when the two ideas energize with your interest, they produce a state of perfect stillness. And in that stillness, you can initiate any direction at all.